How can you have confidence in your first aider when all they have is a certificate to say that no one ever failed, when you have no information about their skills, and when, according to the Resuscitation Council, 70% of CPR done in the UK is delivered below standard and inadequate? In an emergency, survival and recovery depend on the help you get before paramedics arrive. Wouldn't you rather have first aiders at work who can really save lives? Life aiders can. Go to lifeaidtraining.co.uk for details.
It's the Book of the Month on Southside Broadcasting with Jenny Finch, Rob Nichols, Jill Prowse and a host of points to ponder.
The Magic Toy Shop by Angela Carter. This is Angela Carter's second novel and is considered one of her finest early works. It follows the fortunes of Melanie, a precocious 15-year-old from a comfortable and affluent, if somewhat estranged, family. The book opens with Melanie contemplating herself in the mirror and musing on life and what the future might hold. In the middle of the night, she borrows her absent mother's wedding dress and runs out into the darkness wearing it. The night is first exhilarating and then frightening. But when she tries to get back inside, she finds the door is locked. Climbing a tree to her bedroom window, the dress is ripped and stained, ruined beyond repair. When a telegram arrives telling Melanie and her siblings that their parents have been killed in an accident abroad, Melanie believes this is her fault, caused by her behaviour the night before.
Her mother, in particular, was an emphatically clothed woman. Clothed all over, never without stockings, whatever the weather, always gloved and hatted, ready for some outing. A wide-brimmed brown velvet hat with a black ribbon rose at the side superimposed itself on Melanie's picture of her mother being made love to. Melanie remembered that when she was a little girl and her mother cuddled her, the embraces were always thickly muffled in cloth, wool, cotton or linen, according to the season of the year. Her mother must have been born dressed. Perhaps in an elegant, well-fitted cowl selected from a feature in a glossy magazine. What the well-dressed embryo was wearing this year. And Daddy. Daddy was always the same. Tweed and tobacco. Nothing but tweed and tobacco and typewriter ribbon. Of these elements, he was compounded. Her parents' wedding photograph hung over the mantelpiece, where the familiar things seemed exotic and curious in the light of the moon. The French gilt clock, for instance, which told her parents time and had stopped at 3:05 on the day after they left for America. Nobody had bothered to wind it up again. Next to the clock was a Mexican pottery duck, bright, gay and daft, its blue back splotched with yellow flowers. Her mother had bought it after seeing its photograph in a Sunday colour supplement. Melanie wandered over to the mantelpiece, picked up the pottery duck and put it down again, and raised her eyes to the wedding photograph. On her mother's wedding day, she had had an epiphany of clothing. So extravagantly, wholeheartedly had she dressed herself that her flying hems quite obscured Melanie's father. One could only see his shy grin, misted over with blown tully. And Melanie could not tell whether she suspected he was wearing the leather-patched tweed jacket even on his wedding day, because he could not take it off. But her mother exploded in a pyrotechnic display of satin and lace, dressed as for a medieval banquet. Cut low in front to show a love token locket nestling in the hollow of her throat, her white satin dress had scooping sleeves, wide as the wings of swans, and it flowed out from a tiny waist into a great white train, arranged round in front of her for the photograph, so that the dress appeared as if reflected in a pool of itself. A wreath of artificial roses was pressed low down on her forehead, and a fountain of tulle sprang up and around it, and spouted in foam past her waist. She carried a bunch of white roses in her arms, cradled like a baby. Her smile was soppy and ecstatic, and young and touching. She was surrounded by relations of whom they had seen less since Daddy had done so well with the novel, and then the biography and then the film and so on. Aunt Gertrude, too tight perm, awkward feet in too tight shoes, grasping a shiny patent leather handbag like the week's groceries. Melanie remembers the ashes of violet-flavoured kisses of her Aunt Gertrude from the few family Christmases when Grandfather, scowling at the camera as if he expected it to gobble his soul, was alive. Goodbye, Grandfather. Goodbye, Auntie Gertrude. And goodbye, brilliantined Uncle Harry with Auntie Rose on his arm, rouged Auntie Rose. The round patches of rouge came out black in the photograph. She might have been a sweep. They asked along for luck. "Goodbye, Uncle Philip." Unlike the rest, Uncle Philip did not smile at the camera. He might have strayed into the picture from another group, an elk's solemn reunion, or the grand funeral of a member of the Ancient and Honourable Order of Buffaloes, or even from a gathering of veterans of the American Civil War. He wore a flat-topped, curly-brimmed black hat such as Mississippi gamblers wear in Western films, and a black boot-lace tie in a crazy bow. His suit was black, his trousers tight, his jacket long. But the final effect was not of elegance. Under the black hat, his hair seemed to be white, or at least very fair. He had a walrus moustache which concealed his mouth. It was impossible to guess his age. However, he seemed old rather than young. He was tall and of a medium build. His hands were clasped before him on the silver knob of an ebony cane. His expression was quite blank. Too blank, even, to seem bored. Mother's only brother. Her only relative living. For all the others were father's family. And he could not even raise a smile at his sister's wedding. It seemed churlish of him.
The children, Melanie, her younger brother Jonathan, and Victoria, who is about 5, go to live with an unknown Uncle Philip in South London. Here their lives are dominated by the unpredictable and controlling behaviour of their uncle. He's terrorised his wife, Margaret, into profound silence and barely tolerates Margaret's 2 younger brothers, Frankie and Finn. When Philip is at work in the basement of the house, Margaret and her brothers play music and dance in the parlour. But when he emerges, all is silence and obedience, apart from Finn, who seems to delight in defying the master of the house. Uncle Philip is a toy maker, but his obsession is a puppet theatre and the life-size puppets he creates for his own amusement. With echoes of Pygmalion, Philip relates more closely to these wooden figures than to the family occupying the rest of the house.
After this, Finn stopped grinning. After he fell, he changed. His mouth turns sullenly down at the corners like the mouth of a joke mug Melanie had once seen in an antique shop. On the mug was a face, and right side up, lettering over it said, "Full," and the face was beery, jolly and merry. But bottoms up it read, "Empty," and the peaked eyebrows were turned into a drooping and despondent mouth. Thin read, "Empty," all the time. He rarely spoke. His stream of talk was dried up at the source. His head hung down. He grew dirtier than ever, and often would not shave for 3 or 4 days together till his jaw looked coated or grown over with yellow fungus or sprayed like a car with glistening tangerine. Worst of all, his grace was gone. Miraculously, the fall left him whole, with no injury internal or external, but it had shaken the beauty out of his movements. He stumped like an old man. It hurt Melanie to look at him. He was transformed into this sour lump of unbaked dough, and if the old, soft-voiced, slippery-tongued Finn had disturbed her, this new one cut her heart. He ignored her. Not, it seemed, on purpose, but because only Uncle Philip was real to him any more. Mealtimes were desperate. He hardly ate, watching Uncle Philip all the time with fierce, twisted eyes. Finn had moved into a glass box, and never noticed if she or Francie or Aunt Margaret scratched on the glass to attract his attention. Aunt Margaret grew even thinner and more spectral. Her hair, red snakes struggling to free themselves from the hairpins, was the only vital thing about her. Under her red eyebrows were eyes often red with private weeping. Finn still treated her gently, if absently, kissing her goodnight, but as if he had already said goodbye to her somewhere else. Her face was a tragic mask, that of a woman who has sent all her sons to a war and waits hourly for the death telegram. The circle of the red people was broken. Melanie clung above all to Francie, who was always the same. Sometimes she sat in his room with him in the evenings when he practiced, curled up on one or other of the narrow beds with her sewing. She had started to help her aunt with the never-ending sewing. Melanie realised now that she had never needed an invitation to listen to his dancing music. All she had to do was to open the door and walk in. Aunt Margaret never left the kitchen to play her flute with Francie after the fall. "Philip might come up for something," she chalked. But that was pretending. She waited alone in the kitchen for her husband to kill Finn. Melanie knew what she was waiting for, although she had not told her. Melanie expected it herself. Her uncle, in a fury, would lunge at Finn with a knife or a block of wood. Finn, sullen, vindictive, was forcing the killing blow to come to him. The violence in the house was palpable. It trembled on the cold stairs and rose up in invisible clouds from the threadbare carpets. Melanie was afraid at nights when her blue lantern was out and Victoria's cot loomed like a rat trap. She shivered in her lavendered sheets, imploring herself to rest, trying not to think of the dreadful thing Finn had said, that he wanted her uncle to kill him so that her uncle would be damned. One night, she got up and turned on the light and looked at the sweet, bland face of Jesus, the light of the world, in the picture of the mantelpiece. He smiled beneath his crown of thorns.
The book paints a grim picture of life in post-war London. The house has no heating or hot water, and food is heavy, stodgy, and unimaginative. The contrast between this and Melanie's previous life is starkly drawn in a way that seems reminiscent of George Orwell's The Road to Wigan Pier. Only Philip has any money, and Melanie, her siblings, and her aunt are trapped, caught and controlled for Philip's benefit or amusement. In the midst of this lonely, grubby existence, Melanie is drawn into the sinister world of the toy shop and Philip's puppet theatre when she is press-ganged into acting in one of his performances, Leda to his puppet swan. Running through the book is a beautifully drawn story of growing love and friendship between the rest of the family. Aunt Margaret and her brothers and the children come to like and care for one another, and as Melanie grows from girl to young woman, she finds herself increasingly attracted to Finn, who tries to protect her from the worst of her uncle's tyranny. This book is an interesting and skillful mix of fable, fairy tale, and gothic horror, with a strong and shocking finale. Whilst the best and most beautiful writing is in the opening chapter, it is well worth reading, possibly twice, as many details only emerge once the desire to finish the story and find out the ending is satisfied.
It's the Book of the Month on Southside Broadcasting with Jenny Finch, Rob Nichols, Jill Prowse, and a host of points to ponder.
How can you have confidence in your first aider when all they have is a certificate to say that no one ever failed, when you have no information about their skills, and when, according to the Resuscitation Council, 70% of CPR done in the UK is delivered below standard and inadequate? In an emergency, survival and recovery depend on the help you get before paramedics arrive. Wouldn't you rather have first aiders at work who can really save lives? Life Aiders can. Go to lifeaidtraining.co.uk for details.
Book of the Month on Southside Broadcasting. Podbean.com. Probably the best download decision you'll ever make.
Lincoln Inspired is more than just an arts festival. More than a literary festival. More than a whole set of lifestyle opportunities. And more than what the world has needed for millennia.
To see just how much more Lincoln Inspired can make you, go to lincolninspired.co.uk and explore the inspiration.
Parkville is a purpose-built residential care centre situated at the heart of Middlesbrough and providing personalised care in a modern and homely environment. Parkville aims to help older people to continue to live independent and active lives within the wider community whilst benefiting from the care and support of an experienced and dedicated team of nursing and care staff. At Parkville, we provide facilities to accommodate residential elderly and residential EMI service users. To find out more, please telephone 01642 223334. That's 01642 223334. Parkville Care Centre. Care to call us home.
Hundred. his drugs affect 130,000 people in England and Wales each year. He is a recipe that can dramatically decrease your chances of strokes.
Excellent. I better get a pen.
167 grams of calcium, 225
grams of magnesium. Hang on, slow down. One tablespoon.
Remember, any more than one tablespoon could kill you. Any less than one tablespoon could kill you.
Right, what was
and
the recipe?
That's the recipe.
Oh,
if
damn.
You would like a more simple solution, you can always call Pharma Nord on 01670 519989.
All right.
Or visit the website pharmanord.co.uk.
Let me see if I can jot that down. What was the number again?
01670 519989. Or visit the website pharmanord.co.uk.
And how do you spell Pharma Nord, I wonder?
pharmanord.co.uk.
It's almost as if I'm having a conversation with the radio.
Don't be silly, that's impossible.
Pharma Nord, winning the war of nutrition.
You're listening to a Southside Broadcasting podcast. Southside Broadcasting is a media company which aims to provide a wide range of features from the rural, health and lifestyle worlds. You can regularly listen to entertaining podcasts with interviews and correspondence from Los Angeles, Nashville, New York and London. You can take part in our Book of the Month features, grab some great nutritional advice, enjoy broadcasts from the Great Yorkshire Show, the Lincolnshire Show, and enjoy local football reviews with our regular feature, Fly Me to the Moon. You can even hear a BAFTA award-winning director drive a train full of teddy bears. You can listen to these and many more podcasts at southsidebroadcasting.podbean.com. For further information on how you can join over 35,000 people who regularly download our podcasts, call us on 01642 854 742 or email info@southsidebroadcasting.com now.
Hi, this is Jean Bruce Scott.
And Randy Reinholz.
And when we're not busily producing some of the most outstanding Native American theater in Los Angeles,
we always like to check out the best of British audio adventures with Alex Lefchuk and his team of the Midweek Drive.
And Midweek Drive morning editions on Siren FM.
And Southside Broadcasting. Podbean.com.
Jenny Finch, author, creator of The Drowners and Death of the Elver Man, and general Renaissance woman, your host for the Book of the Month.
Yeah, quite literally. Generally a Renaissance woman. Jenny, thank you. It's off and running, your first ever Book of the Month. And it's quite an interesting one to take us through the whole system. Of course, Angela Carter and the Magic Toy Shop.
Well, yes, Alex, it's lovely to be here.
Oh, absolutely. In case you're wondering, of course, the team, they haven't just left us in every sense of the word, but Jill Prowse has had to have root canal surgery. Mm-hmm. Return from that. And Rob Nichols, he's sorting out a few other bits and pieces as well. But Rob, at least before he went, we decided to actually ask him, what did Rob make of Angela Carter's Magic Toy Shop?
Really interesting book, I think. It's Angela Carter, I think somebody I've always been aware of, films, things like that. And
Company of Wolves.
Company of Wolves, exactly. And I think she likes to take some sort of like fairy tale and twist it a little bit. She did there, but this again is quite a dark tale. And I think it keeps you guessing. I think it's interesting that it's become like a period piece. Although it's probably I'm looking at it thinking when was this written? But it was written a few years ago, and when we had shillings and pounds, shillings and pence, and it's a really interesting story, and a few twists, and quite dramatic, and nice to sort of get into the minds of a family that have been wrenched from a safe sort of environment and put into this alien environment, and it's really interesting how everything changes.
It's fascinating that it was written in 1967.
Yeah.
Because when I was reading it, I thought, at times it reads very like a period piece, and yet some of the questions and the experiences that the youngsters actually have in their original thing suggest that actually, you know, they had a reasonable settlement, and they're suddenly dumped into this London environment,
yes,
which is very scary, very strange. We've got the mute aunt there, you've got the sort of ferocious character of the toy maker and so on, and you've got the two Irish lads, so you're never quite sure where they're coming from. I think she writes well from the child's perspective.
Yeah, definitely. From what was a 15-year-old girl, isn't it? And
of course, her brother who likes to make ships.
And basically, that's all he does, isn't he? He makes ships. And that is his life. And I like the passages where we look through his eyes of behind his glasses, his thick glasses, and all he is seeing is ships,
exactly,
and the rigging and everything to do with it.
Yeah. And I think the description of his sister, or the child's sister, and the 15-year-old's sister as well,
yeah,
that actually quite well, quite heartrending in many ways. Right?
Yeah.
I thought it worked on that basis. Published by Virago, of course, created a reputation as being mostly a women-only based house from that point of view, and seen in terms of the very title of Virago as maybe being a bit alien. How did you feel as a man reading the book from Angela Carter?
I've not read anything by Angela Carter for many years, and I regret it in a way, because I think
it's always time, Rob.
Absolutely. Well, I've read something now, and no, I think it's a really, really, it's an excellent piece of work. It is amazing. It's 1967, and you're constantly thinking, when is this set all the way through? And it's interesting how much has changed. Even if it was the 1970s, how much change has been since the 60s. When you get off the beaten track of the Beatles and the swinging 60s and stuff, it's a very different world.
There were certainly sort of moments when I was reading the text where one sensed that she not only captured the period, but almost managed to riff on Wizard of Oz and a variety of other sort of classic things. Narnia, crept through, and certainly from the opening sequence we went to all that. Okay, so it is time to actually reach the scores on the doors, and obviously we'll find out from our colleagues where they're going for as far as this is concerned. What are you going to give the Magic Toy Shop?
Marks out of 10, 9.
From the magic of the mind to the excellence of eternity, this is the Book of the Month podcast from Southside Broadcasting, a whole new area of broadcasting excellence.
Okay, so I think Rob was extremely generous with respect to that. I had a wry smile, Jenny, when I looked at the Observer little strapline here, which says, in reference to The Magic Toy Shop by Angela Carter, her writing is pyrotechnic. I'm having a slight smile there, given no spoilers alert here in terms of what's happening. Fueled with ideas, packed with images, and spangling the night with her starry language.
Certainly starry language, yes. She's got a wonderful vocabulary, this woman.
And again, worked extremely well from that point of view. Is this the kind of book, Cody, you would want to pick up and read and go through that?
Well, certainly by looking at the front, it's not what I expected, but I think it would be a good read, yeah.
Okay, I mean, the cover, actually, Jenny, is worth noting. The one that we've actually reviewed for this particular production is best described, again, as a young lady dressed in a diaphanous silk or such-like gown, being terrified by a swan, which is effectively a puppet swan, in essence.
Yes.
So the sort of key things.
The key moment within the book, I think.
Yeah. And that certainly created a bit of a furore, as opposed to anything else recently, with respect to obviously banning books, and, well, not banning books, but ensuring that basically awarding books certificates in the same way that movies and various other video games are awarded certificates.
There was quite a strong push towards labelling books as suitable only for above a certain age.
Yeah.
And this particular cover is in a style that's used for children's books and could be extremely misleading.
Yeah.
And I would be somewhat apprehensive if a precocious 10 or even precocious 15-year-old picked up this and read it. It's not a book for children.
I find it a very dark book overall.
Yeah.
Not only for the fact that we don't know what happens to Edward Bear other than being burnt alive.
That was sad.
I thought so. And in addition to that, we also have a really little knowledge about Melanie's other siblings. You know, there is an essence there in terms of, I felt that it was almost an unsatisfactory ending, because we have the two, in a sense you might say, romantic leads who escape, but then everything else is left to effectively heck in a hand basket, basically.
Well, yes, they're possibly left to burn to death, or there is a line that says they're fairly sure the brother Jonathan's probably escaped, you know, perhaps metaphorically sailed away somewhere. But nobody else seems to have a firm ending, apart from Uncle Philip, who gets his comeuppance, and that's fine as far as I'm concerned. Thoroughly unpleasant man.
He wasn't nice at all, was he, really?
Absolutely.
Any sense of the word, really. And I think not only from a point of view of culture, it was just a bizarre setup. Jill Prowse actually had her own view, saying it was a strange book, and she'd give it a 7. I was on a 6.5 for a long period of time. I'm trying to move up to a 7. No, it's going to stay a 6.5. I just felt that in terms of the piece, yes, it is very well written. It is structurally interesting. It's fascinating in terms of the line that's actually there. But again, without necessarily saying there's anything wrong with sort of dark characters, and I thought some of the riffs that were sort of going through there in terms of translating into the way in which a character moves from one world, one experience to and the perspective that was written from Melanie as well. Maybe I could give it a 7. So what the hey? I mean, I'm sort of talking myself into the whole system here. But it was one of those where I think I'd echo your own point, Jenny, that I don't know. But Jenny, what would you give your first official Book of the Month as coordinator and presenter?
Well, I think I'd give it 7.5. The opening chapter is beautifully written and is very atmospheric, so visual. It's better than anything else in the book. It's almost a... it's almost a different book within itself. It's a very clever remaking of Cinderella, I think, in a lot of ways. And it is a forerunner of what's now called magic realism. It was written in 1967. It reflects a lot of the literature of around that time. It reminded me of The Girls of Slender Means. But I think it's actually based around about the mid-50s to very early 60s, because I lived in not such mean, horrible houses, but under very similar circumstances to those when I was... I've given my age away. When I was a mere baby.
Sure, yeah. Time travelling
and
again.
She does draw that incredibly well. Yeah. So I go for 7.5.
Yeah, I'm sort of sensing probably Clapham, that kind of South London environment that were there, Crystal Palace, Dulwich, that zone in
Peckham.
Terms of where the Peckham, yes, that sort of area with the route is. Didn't really get a sense of where they originally lived other than somewhere up the north, probably, I don't know, Midlands or whatever. But the train journey, I thought, was very well put together.
Yeah.
I think I was expecting slightly more because it started off so strongly.
Yes.
But then it threw me into a completely different area, because it went from, as you say, it's magic realism. Is that not a tautology? But in terms of the system, it was working through that. So from what we've said, Kayleigh Carr, is this the sort of book you'd actually say, yes, I want to get hold of a copy of that?
Well, when I first looked at it, I thought, yeah, I may as well give this a go, but...
May as well give it a go,
The discussion has kind of got me saying no.
Ooh.
Unfortunately.
Well, Angela has written quite a lot, and I'm sure that every so often she might not necessarily have started. I don't think we've actually had an adaptation of the Magic Toy Shop that I can recall. Not a sort of major one. It'd be interesting to see whether any cinematic maker would actually take on the very interesting topic that would sort of come through from that perspective.
Yes.
Because suffice it to say, Kayleigh, it's there's a kind of bounds on the fact that the reason for, again, the mute character of the wife of the uncle, who I thought was, again, profoundly mute in terms of the system, mute on her wedding day, and works with an interesting sort of relationship she has with her brother, which we won't go any further in, basically.
That's enough said.
What's the Book of the Month for next month going to be, Jenny Finch?
It's going to be The Book Thief, one of my favourites.
Number one international bestseller by Marcus Zusak, which, as The Guardian says, a novel of breathtaking scope, masterfully told. So like The Observer's, her writing is pyrotechnic. Don't forget, you can always access these again if you're listening live on the James Cook University Hospital and you want to say, I want to listen to that again, southsidebroadcasting.podbean.com. Kayleigh Carr, many thanks.
Thank you.
Jenny Finch, thank you.
Thank you.
Can we say bye-bye?
Bye.
It's the Book of the Month on Southside Broadcasting with Jenny Finch, Rob Nichols, Jill Prowse, and a host of points to ponder.